crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome to Watch Jerusalem. I'm Brent Nuchtigal. Based on events this past week, Now Media, based in Lebanon, ran an analysis piece entitled "The Iranian Empire is Back." This is something that we've been saying for decades now, that Iran not only desires an empire, but that they will get it, even if it is for a brief moment in time. On today's program, we'll look and explore what made Hassan Abdel Hafsan make that claim, as well as how the Bible in detail explains both what Iran's strategy is in the Middle East right now, and also how far along they will make it before they get stopped by a superior power. Then, for the second half of today's show, we'll look at some of the earliest roots of the Iranian Empire. We'll go back some 2,500 years and discuss who is arguably Iran's greatest monarch. We'll also look at one reason why the current Iranian leadership seeks to undermine parts of their own history. Welcome once again to Watch Jerusalem. While there have been many writers that have talked about the rise of Iran over the past 5 to 10 years, Hassan Abdel Hassan, writing for Now, a Lebanese-based website, takes it one step further and says that the Iranian Empire is back. The Iranian Empire is back. And I'll have the link for this down the bottom of the show notes if you want to read it. But I'd just like to quote the first couple of paragraphs of his article as we get into this topic. He writes, "For the first time since 625 CE, Iran has restored its control over the contiguous territory that extends from east of Afghanistan to the Mediterranean coast. With the complete collapse of the Syrian armed opposition expected before the end of the year, Tehran would have subdued the three Arab countries that are sandwiched between its western border and the Mediterranean. The dream of the founder of the Islamic Republic and its first supreme guide will be nationally recognized." Then he offers proof of this, and instead of talking about how the Syrian regime is going to be successful, at least according to him, in the battle against the rebels, he looks at two events in this past week that have something to do with that, yet they are a little bit different, as being the rationale behind his headline that Iran has this empire between Afghanistan and the Mediterranean coast. The first event he talks about is the announcement that Hezbollah is going to be part of the Syrian Arab army's elite forces. They're actually being included in the command structure of the Syrian army. Now, of course, when you talk about this event, this is a big deal. Hezbollah, we know, that's been fighting, has been fighting in Syria since 2012. At first, it tried to hide the fact from the Lebanese people that that they were fighting alongside the Syrians in support of them, because it would have shown to the Lebanese public what was already known to most others, that Hezbollah was in fact purely an Iranian surrogate, and when push came to shove, it would answer to Iran rather than to protect its own people. And Iran made the call, Hezbollah answered, and they started to fight in Syria, supporting Assad there and jeopardizing really the border of Lebanon and Syria, just in case the enemies could come and try and bring the fight to Lebanon, which they have been trying to do so far. So Hezbollah has been fighting in Syria for a number of years. They've lost over 1,000 men, but now they're actually joining the official army of the Syrians and working within the command structure of the Syrian 5th Army Corps. This means that Iran is going to have its own troops, basically, inside the Syrian force. Now, the second event that took place this week happened in Iraq. Now, this too was somewhat predictable, and it was only a matter of time really before this happened. But last Saturday, not yesterday, the week before, there was a vote in the Iraqi government that fully legalized state-sanctioned Shiite militias, making them an official part of the government forces. Now, what this means is, in effect, that this law now adds over 100,000 Shiite members, fighters, to Iraq's security establishment. And yet, the Shiite militias The popular mobilization force being the largest of these. They don't answer to Iraq. They answer to Iran, the Shiite powerhouse next door. Now, these Shiite militias, they were used to liberate, in quotes, Fallujah earlier this year, which resulted in a number of atrocities against the liberated Sunnis that were there. Of course, this was a city that was taken over by the Islamic State. And yet, these forces, when the Shiite militias, as they were coming in there to liberate this city, they did perform a lot of acts against the Sunnis of those cities that were meant to be liberated from the Islamic State, and yet a number of them were killed. Many of them were tortured. To these Shiites, these parts of these militias, who take their orders from Iran and directions from Iran, yet are now part of Iraq's official army, these view any Sunnis really that were underneath Islamic State's rule in many cases as apostates. They argue that the very fact that the Islamic State left these Sunnis there shows that they didn't try hard enough to get out from underneath their rule. Now, these Shiite militias, they've been on their best behavior of late as they try to liberate Mosul, Iraq's second largest city. But one only needs to remember a month ago when these forces came into Mosul, there were their SUVs blaring not Iraq's national anthem, but Shiite anthems. They didn't carry Iraq's flag, but rather Shiite flags. That is their true cause. It is a religious war, and they are answering to Iran. Now, according to the Associated Press, there are many inside Iraq's government that weren't happy with this, and yet what they're seeing is the Iraqi government is being taken over by the Shiites, and of course, they look to their religious leadership in Iran. The Associated Press writes, quote, "The legislation supported by 208 of the 327 chamber members was quickly rejected by Sunni Arab politicians and lawmakers as proof of the dictatorship of the country's Shiite majority and evidence of its failure to honor promises of inclusion." So this is interesting. These two events are what has caused the media to run with a really loud headline stating that the Iranian Empire is back. Because we have now Iranian fighters, basically Hezbollah, in part of Syria's army, and we have these Shiite militias that make the most effective ground force against the Islamic State, over 100,000 men as part of Iraq's security establishment by law now. Now, this is something we've expected for a long time and something we've been looking for to happen for a long time. Iran, of course, is using ISIS as an excuse to increase its presence in Iraq and Syria. And there is some research out there that indicates that Iran allowed the Islamic State to rise as a precursor or a motivation for itself to get more involved and then gobble up the power in these two countries. And that's what we're seeing right now. That yes, you might have a figurehead in a body as the president of, or the leader of Iraq, and then you might have Assad as being the leader of Syria. Yet we have Iranian forces that answer to Iran, not those leaders, individual leaders of those states, inside their very own military establishment. This is something new. This means Iran controls part of the command structure for two armies on the way towards the Middle East, and we already know that southern Lebanon is dominated by Hezbollah as well, an Iranian proxy organization that's determined to not just fight to support Assad, but to destroy Israel. Now, I guess from Israel's perspective, the one good thing about Iran's bolstering of the Syrians has been the fact that over the past few years, Iran and Hamas, the terrorist organization based out of the Gaza Strip, but that would like to increase its involvement in the West Bank. They used to be close allies, but since 2012, that relationship's been on ice. Hamas was not happy that its Sunni brothers were being slaughtered in Syria, and even told Iran so. And this led to the breakup of the two over the past 4 or 5 years. But recently, this ice has begun to thaw. And this is a piece from Khaled Abu Tomeh. He writes for Gladstone Institute, November 23rd. So we have, again, Iran infiltrating the army of Iraq by law now, and them being part of the military of Damascus, of the Syrians, and they're trying to, as much as they can, to get involved with Hamas again in Israel. This is what the Gladstone Institute wrote. Proof of Iran's renewed effort to infiltrate the Palestinian arena was provided this week by statements made by a senior Hamas official, Osama Hamdan, who is in charge of the Islamist movement's external affairs. He was asked about Hamas's relationship with Iran, and Hamdan was quoted as saying that he had good reason to be optimistic. Quote, "Relations between Iran and Hamas are currently undergoing revitalization and are moving in the right direction." Then he went on to explain that moving in the right direction means that Iran would continue to support the resistance against Israel. Now, there have been obviously close relationships between Iran and Hamas over the period of 25 years in Hamas's existence, and there have been some flaws in that relationship, of course, and even the Syrian civil war has exposed that. Yet really, as this writer points out, the crisis between the two sides over the civil war in Syria is no more than a minor tactical dispute. And when it comes to the real agenda, such as destroying Israel, launching terror attacks, Iran and Hamas continue to be in total alignment. Now, just those stories shows that Iran does want to govern the territory from Afghanistan to the Mediterranean. And included in that is its desire to take Jerusalem as well. And they're going to use, or try and use, Hamas to accomplish that purpose. Now, if we get back to Hassan's piece, the one that talks about Iran and this empire that's growing across to the Mediterranean Sea from its own borders, he talks about how Iran is actually following the method of its ancient kings, its ancient Persian kings. And I'll just quote him again. He says, "The model of local kings, historically known as satraps, in ancient Iran, is an old Persian scheme. After invading neighboring territories and forcing their leaders to concede, rulers of ancient Iran would keep the local king in power, on the condition that the king pledges allegiance to Iran's king, or Shah in Persian. Thus, the Iranian ruler became the king of kings, Shahinshah." Then he writes, "The last Iranian Shahinshah lost control over the Mediterranean coast to Byzantine Emperor Heraclius, who ruled between 610 and 641 and launched his war against the Persian Empire in 622 CE. Since then, no Iranian sovereign has ruled any stretch of land west of the Euphrates until the recent collapse of the three neighboring Arab governments of Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon." Now look at what we're viewing here. This is historic. Historic. For 1,500 years, no Iranian has ruled over territory west of the Euphrates River. And yet now what are we seeing? Their own forces being part of the command structures of these armies west of the Euphrates, all the way to the Mediterranean coast. The last time this has happened is 622 CE, a long time ago. And yet that's in reality what we're seeing right now. Now he continues, "Such collapses came under different circumstances, but the end result has been the same. Now Iran is the actual sovereign over these three Arab states." That's pretty scary. That's pretty scary when you consider that those three Arab states push up against the borders of Jordan and Israel, really surrounding the northern parts of Israel. So that's what a scholar, a writer from Lebanon has to say about what's happening. But the Bible actually gives a more specific forecast than that. And the Bible is very clear in what Iran is trying to do here. They've shown their hand recently, the Iranians have, by their actions here and by infiltrating the Iraqi and the Syrian army. By request or by voluntarily being admitted into it. But the Bible does get so much more specific about their actions right now in the Middle East. And when we come back, we're going to look at what the Bible says about what Iran is trying to do.
This is Trumpet Radio, 101.3, KPCG and kpcg.fm. The podcast of each show is available at thetrumpet.com, at kpcg.fm and at iTunes.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. So the big question is, what's next? What happens after Iran influences events like it has done in Iraq and Syria? Well, Hassan notes in his piece that Iran will likely shift its attention to more distant regions. He talks about Bahrain, Kuwait, and possibly even Saudi Arabia. Iran trying to get involved in there, mobilizing more of its proxy forces. And while he does believe that expansion in Iran's expansion across the Middle East, he doesn't go far enough, because the Bible actually indicates that Iran is going to go further than the Arabian Peninsula. He's going to go across North Africa, East Africa, specifically Egypt, Ethiopia, and Libya. How can we know that? How can we know that Iran has those countries and those nations in its sights? Well, the book of Daniel prophesies, actually, that in this end time, there are going to be a number of nations allied with Iran. And we base this prophecy off scriptures in Daniel chapter 11. And I just want to read you Daniel chapter 11, verse 40, one of the key prophecies about events in this end time. It writes, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." So notice here that you have two kings, the king of the south and the king of the north. Well, who is the king of the south? Well, we've written so many pieces on that subject over the past 25 years, and we've labeled that king of the south as Iran, leading radical Islam. That is the king of the south. Now, those familiar with the book of Daniel know that chapter 11 of Daniel talks about this king of the south and this king of the north in great detail throughout the whole chapter. Now, anciently, the king of the north was the Seleucid Empire, and that came into power after the breakup of Alexander the Great's empire in the late 3rd century BCE. Seleucid Empire, it was based out of Antioch in Syria today, and ruled over quite a large territory, the largest of the kings to come out of Alexander the Great's empire. He was the king of the north, and the dynasty that would spring from him, Seleucus. Now, the king of the south, that was the Ptolemaic Empire based in Egypt. Now, anciently, these empires, these kingdoms rather, they fought a number of battles against each other, vying for power, and stuck right in the middle of them was the borderland of Judea, or where the Jews were. Now, once you get to the latter part of that chapter in Daniel chapter 11, it starts talking about what's going to happen in the latter time, as we just read in verse 40. Now, the king of the north and the king of the south no longer represent the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire. Last time I checked, they're not around. So who could they be? Who could those scriptures be referring to? Who is the king of the north and who is the king of the south? They need to be around today. But you know what? Almost nobody knows who they are. Here you have some of the most dramatic prophecies in the Bible, and nobody knows who these kings represent. Well, you can know. Watch Jerusalem editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has written a book entitled King of the South. It's quite a large book. You can read it now by downloading it for free at Watch Jerusalem, or you can request a hard copy and we'll send that to you anywhere in the world for free. And let me tell you, reading that book will stun you in its accuracy in labeling Iran as the king of the South, especially because it labeled Iran that back in 1993. And if we know that they're the king of the South, we can also know who Iran is going to be allied with. Daniel 11, verse 42, just two verses after verse 40, says, "He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape." Now, we're not going to talk about who's doing the fighting against the King of the South, who this King of the North is. That booklet, The King of the South, describes the King of the North as well. But we see here that this opposite army opposing the King of the South is going to tackle Egypt as well. Why are they going to come against Egypt? Well, because Egypt is going to be allied with Iran. That wouldn't be necessary unless Egypt was allied with Iran. Just a little reading between the lines here makes it pretty obvious what that means, that allied with the King of the South or Iran is going to be Egypt. Now, that some people say, well, how in the world could Iran be allied with Egypt? Egypt, Sunni power, Iran, Shiite power, historically, they have been enemies, both vying for leadership over the Middle East, well, and Islam, along with the Saudis, of course. Well, you can just take a look back in 2012 when Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood got in power. Yes, Mohamed Morsi represented a Sunni group and Iran is Shiite, but nevertheless, no matter, Iran didn't mind and neither did Morsi. They were exchanging visits, exchanging embassies in each other's countries. They were really cozying up to one another. Now, that didn't last long because Morsi was removed from power, but it did indicate how easy Iran could be aligned with Egypt. But let's see a little bit more from this prophecy in Daniel, because it really does, again, plot the growth of the Iranian empire. People see that Iran is growing an empire, and yet they don't go far enough, or they don't realize how large Iran's ambition is and how far-reaching they're going to stretch out their hand to try and find more allies. And demand more allies, really. Let's look at chapter 11 again, verse 43. It says, "But he, the king of the north, then, this other king, shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps." So it's interesting here. It talks about how these are going to be other nations that are at the steps of this other king fighting the king of the south. Or at his beck and call, because they're going to be defeated as well, because they were aligned with the King of the South as well, the Libyans and the Ethiopians. Now, why? Now we're getting a picture of who this King of the South is allied with. If you look at a map, you can see where these nations are located, and basically where ancient Libya was and modern Libya, it's around the same area, and the same with Ethiopia, extending up to Egypt, and both of them surround Egypt. So you know that there is this corridor here of northeast Africa that Iran is going to control. They are going to control. And this area, it does occupy the region surrounding the Red Sea. Surrounding the Red Sea. And from this prophecy back in the book of Daniel, again, written 2,500 years ago, the editor of Watch Jerusalem said that it's likely Yemen's going to go as well. Yemen is going to go towards Iran. He wrote that before the Houthi rebellion, before people started saying back in the start of 2015, once the capital Sana'a fell to the Houthis in Yemen, again, off along this Red Sea corridor. He said that they were going to likely form part of, or Iran would want them to form part of the King of the South, this conglomerate of nations that is headed by Iran. Because Iran wants to dominate this trade route. And Yemen would be an important nation for them to hold. And now they have Yemen, basically, because of the Houthi rebellion there, another one of its proxies. Now, the next dominoes to fall will be Ethiopia, Egypt, and at least part of Libya. Now, people might say, well, Ethiopia's Christian, that'll never happen. Okay, but that's what they said about Egypt as well. Egypt might not have been Christian, but its goals and its historic relationship with Iran hasn't been friendly. And yet, it was so easy for Egypt to change over the night just because of a leadership change. So it's good to remember that while Iran does follow the Shiite tenets of Islam, they are Islamic first and foremost. And at least in the short term, they intend to lead an Islamic awakening in all Muslim nations. It's not necessarily about Shiite versus Sunnis for them. It's about power, the Iranians. And the fact that their alliances are going to, well, this alliance, as biblically prophesied, will include Sunni powers indicates that they are willing to forego a little bit of Shiite dominance to ensure that there is Islamic dominance over the Middle East and that they are the head of it. Now, I'm going to read part of a quote here from The Islamic Awakening, Iran's Grand Narrative of the Arab Uprisings. And this was written by Dr. Payam Mohseni. And this piece says, contrary to what is commonly assumed, however, Iran's narrative of the Islamic Awakening and its promotion of Islamic government are not tied to the Iranian state model or to any other specific institution model for that matter. So he's saying the way they're going about this Islamic awakening, they're not really bound by their own nation-state model. They're trying to reach out to these other players in the region, and by really encouraging any type of Islamic awakening, religious awakening. Khamenei noted that, quote, system building is your pivotal and main task, a complex and challenging affair, he writes, but one that can be achieved through different methods and forms depending on the particular conditions that exist across the diversity of the countries. So he's saying here that, you know, the world does get hooked up on, and strategists in the Middle East get hooked up on Sunni versus Shiite, yet there is something that is greater than that, according to the leader of Iran, the true leader, the supreme leader. He writes, continuing, the ultimate goal must be a unified Islamic nation and the establishment of new Islamic civilization based on religion, rationalism, science, and morality. And so that's what they're after. He warned foreign delegates then in this piece to not allow secular or Western liberal or extremist national leftist Marxist models to be opposed on you. So notice that it is about religion, but it's mostly about power and Iran controlling the Islamic uprising across the Middle East and the world, really. They want to be the head of it. They don't really care what version of Islam, at least in the short term, that you follow, as long as you recognize that Iran is leading this movement. That's what they care most about. And if you see that, and if you approach it in that light, then it's easy to see how they could get Egypt to be on their side, Libya to be on their side. The Bible shows that they are going to gobble up Iraq. They are going to gobble up Yemen, Ethiopia, Libya, Egypt, and likely another couple of nations along the Red Sea corridor. But they're only going to get so far in this. Now, when you see headlines in a newspaper that talk about an Iranian empire, recognize that this is the biblical king of the south. Kings have kingdoms. And Iran is leading a charge for a kingdom. And with events this week, they have done a great job at that, or increasing their holdings in Iraq, in Syria, and we already know that they're gobbling up Yemen. Next thing we need to be watching for is how they influence events in Egypt. Now, to get a more in-depth analysis, I recommend reading The King of the South, or go to our prophecy page at Watch Jerusalem. It might take an hour of your life to read through that whole prophecy page, but after you do that, you'll have a better idea of what Iran is up to, and you'll know the outcome. You'll know, more importantly, if or how it could actually affect you individually as well, if you read that prophecy page. Now, when we come back, we're going to look at a Persian king, one very important one in the Bible, actually, that the Bible has plenty to say about, and one who even condemns the actions of today's Persian leaders. We'll be right back.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The King of the South is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the Literature tab to select your free booklet.
This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'd just like to start this portion by talking about a story from Reuters, and this is dated from October 31st, so it's about a month ago. It's just very interesting. It says, Iran's Islamic Republic has arrested the organizers of a march last week near the tomb of the ancient Persian king Cyrus the Great that attracted thousands of people celebrating the country's pre-Islamist glory. The article continues, this is from Reuters again. Crowds of mostly young Iranians attended the march near the ancient city of Parsa Gedeia in central province of Fars on Friday to celebrate the day officially marked in the Iranian calendar as Cyrus Day. Then videos released on social media showing them chanting, Iran is our country, quote, Cyrus is our father. Now, then we have a prosecutor here that arrested them. He said that the main leaders and organizers of this gathering who chanted unconventional slogans against the Islamic Republic's values have been arrested. And then another Shiite cleric came out and said, quote, these people are against the revolution. I wonder how they can gather about Cyrus's tomb and chant the same slogans about Cyrus that we chant about our supreme leader. So you've got some really interesting events here taking place in Iran. The Cyrus Day comes up. That is not really by the government of Iran right now. It was 40 years ago, but not right now. That they don't like. And you have some people celebrating this day, really bringing back the most glorious part of Iran's history from 2,600 years ago. And they get arrested for doing it. Now, why would that be the case? Why are they so upset with this man named Cyrus? Now, Cyrus was one of the greatest ancient kings. He was around about 1,000 years before Islam actually reached Iran. And he ruled in a way of religious tolerance and benevolence upon the people that he conquered. A little different to the type of leadership that the current Iranian leadership aspires. And we're just going to talk about a little bit about Cyrus now. Cyrus the Great, the very first Iranian emperor once the Babylonian kingdom fell. And he ruled the Persian Empire from 559 to 530 BC. And the history of his life, that's well documented both by Greek and Roman historians, and also a lot of archaeological evidence has come up as well. And of his many feats, Cyrus did conquer the invincible Babylonian Chaldean Empire. And then he established Persia as a world power, something that you would think the Iranian leadership would want to hang on to. And of course, they did. The Shah of Iran, before he was removed in the Islamic Revolution, the overthrow back in 1979, he did hearken back to this history. And it is glorious history for the Iranians and history that they can be proud of. And yet it's a history they want to try and sweep under the carpet today because of Cyrus's actions. Under Cyrus, the Persian Empire rapidly expanded to create to that point, the largest empire that humanity had ever seen. It went all the way from Central Asia up to northern Turkey, as far south, Libya. And, I mean, it had parts of Greece, Bulgaria as well. Just a huge swath of land. But he wasn't just a conqueror, and that's probably why or what separates him from the leaders before him. He heralded a new breed of leadership and politics. Unlike the Assyrians, he didn't rule exclusively with the sword and the spear. His subjects were not beaten, tortured, and killed into acquiescence or cooperation. Sometimes they were killed, of course. But he ruled as a humanitarian. This is what Encyclopedia Britannica says about him. Cyrus was an outstanding soldier and statesman. He founded an empire that stretched from the Indus to the Aegean and borders of Egypt, and left behind him a reputation for justice and clemency. And the new mainstream of civilization says this about him: Cyrus created a new type of empire. Under the close supervision of his government, he permitted the conquered peoples to retain their own customs and religions and their own forms of government. Now, this was groundbreaking, earth-shaking, a new way of leading for a world that was all about being cruel and had forced governance. King Cyrus' disposition was revolutionary, and it was welcomed, of course, by his subjects and the people that he conquered. Now, Cyrus, of course, he's well known in the Bible. He's mentioned by name in the book of Isaiah, 150 years before he was even born. And before he would, it mentions that he would conquer Babylon, the greatest city of the ancient world. Again, 150 years before he actually did it. And now, if you have trouble believing that, I suggest you read Brad McDonald's article and Watch Jerusalem right now. It goes into far greater depth of Cyrus's great feats, and you can find that just on the homepage there. And again, I'll leave it in the notes here below this program. But he was a leader for the ages, one that really did set the course for the other Persian kings that would come after him. Darius, Xerxes, Artaxerxes, they ruled in a similar way. They followed the lead of their Iranian forefather, leader. Now, I think, obviously, the main reason that the Iranian Islamic Revolution seeks to undermine its own history is because of another critical part of Cyrus's history that's well attested to by archaeology. In 1879, British archaeologists digging in Iran discovered a barrel-shaped cylinder that was made out of clay, and inscribed on that cylinder in ancient cuneiform was a decree by this man, King Cyrus of Persia. And what is it? It's a 40-line decree where the king recalls his defeat of Babylon, but then after that, he clearly outlines a number of policies that were designed to defend the rights of the conquered, the people he just whooped up on. He said that there's going to be some rights for those people, the Babylonians. You can find this incredible artifact, the Cyrus Cylinder. I had the privilege of seeing it just a couple of months ago. It's in the British Museum. The Cyrus Cylinder, it really confirms the historical record showing that King Cyrus displayed a tremendous and from that before that point, unprecedented respect and tolerance for peoples around the world. The United Nations calls the Cyrus Cylinder the world's first charter of human rights. And it is really proof that King Cyrus was one of mankind's great humanitarians. But really what's important about this is because what the Bible says about Cyrus. The Bible is quite clear about what Cyrus did for the Jews. The Jews, who is arguably Iran's greatest enemy people today. And yet it wasn't always like that. You read through pages of the Bible, the end of the book of Chronicles, Esther. You read Ezra, Nehemiah. And who's in power? Who's the empire of that day that those books were written under? That it was the Persian Empire, from Cyrus on down. And each of those leaders, Xerxes, Artaxerxes, Darius, all of them, gave special favor to the Jews. Of course, Cyrus was the one that allowed them to return. He even gave them funds to send them back to Judea, Yehud, as it was called then, to build it back up, build the temple, and set up Zerubbabel to be governor of that territory. This is the same Cyrus. This is the Iranian lineage, heritage. And yet that beautiful history is being washed away, or at least attempted to, by the current administration government in Iran. Now, I mean, Cyrus wasn't the only one. If you want to talk about Darius, he had a separate decree. Then Artaxerxes, he had a separate decree as well to allow Ezra and Nehemiah to go back there about 60 years after Zerubbabel, 70 years after Zerubbabel. So this was established policy of the Persian Empire, of the Iranian Empire. It was to allow the Jews back and give them freedom to build, freedom of religion as well. And that is probably one of the things that the Islamic Revolution and the Imams over there and the Ayatollah hates the most about their own heritage. And yet it is a beautiful bit of heritage for the Iranians. It goes completely against the current tenets of the Islamic Revolution. But there it is, black and white, ancient cuneiform, really, that Cyrus believed in religious tolerance and that the native peoples could return to their land, they could build their places of worship. Truly, Cyrus was Persia's greatest king and one that the Iranian leadership today could take note of. I would really encourage you to go back and read that article by Brad McDonald on watchjerusalem.co.il and you really educate yourself on King Cyrus and the foundation of the Iranian Empire, because what you see today isn't true to their history. This is an anomaly, and the Bible talks about its end, and the Bible also talks about its stunning beginning. Well, that's about all we have time for today. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @watch_Jerusalem. You can like our Facebook page as well. Or if you'd like to send us some feedback here in Jerusalem, you can do that by emailing letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. Or you can write to P.O. Box 8314 Jerusalem, Israel 910-8201. Thanks again for listening to Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.